It's our betrothal day, and even now the Grand Army of New Amsterdam is drilling for a spectacular parade in your honor.
You're hearing a bunch of crazy music on the return of Rick Coogan to After Hours in 2018 from a actually fascinating CD called Kurt Vile, From Berlin to Broadway. So that's what you'll be hearing. It is my great pleasure, thrill, and indeed honor to have for this first hour Robert Jordan. You knew him from television, from, God, Bob, almost half a century on television. We're going to talk, and you know, he's not going to tell you exactly, you know, the inside story on Tom Skilling or anything, because he has written one of the most, and I say this as a former TV critic and also as a devout lover of the city of Chicago, one of the most provocative and thought-provoking and also in its way entertaining. I don't want to make this sound like it's some academic treatise. It is a powerful and entertaining book. It is titled Murder in the News, an inside look at how television covers crime. I'm sorry you're only here for an hour, Bob, because this is a topic we could talk about forever.
Oh, thank you so much.
Forever. You're born and raised in Atlanta.
Right.
When did you first, I'm trying to think, we're of the same kind of vintage, mm-hmm. the kind of vintage who hates cold weather and hates to stay up late. But what, as a kid, I never, even watching television, aspired to television news. I'm not even sure I remember what television news was.
Well, there
was
a television news when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talk in the book about my life and how there's some very interesting parallels. And I remember coming home from elementary school with my best friend, Med Dennis. And Med told me, my dad just bought something called a television, and he's got it at home.
Let's go see it.
Yeah. And so we went over to his house, and there it was, this box. And it didn't come on. And we were in Nashville, Tennessee then.
Yeah.
And it didn't come on until late afternoon with a cowboy program. And so we would turn it on and just watch the test pattern for
I remember that too.
30 or 40 minutes until the first program came on. That's
so
how fascinating.
You and I are then two people who came of age, chronological age, as television came of age.
Correct.
I remember here, certainly, I'm sure a lot of listeners do here, getting the weather from P.J. Hoff, who would stick his head out the window and tell you what it was and then draw little suns or little you know, raindrops or something. Do you remember your first experience with television news as a viewer?
Wow. As a viewer with television news, I'm thinking, you know, I remember the Edward R. Murrow shows, and I loved them. And those were quasi-news entertainment with the interviews. But yet, I do remember those. And that sort of morphed into more of television news when Walter Cronkite, of course, came along, and Eric Severide and some of the early CBS guys who were the beginning people whom I worked with later in the 70s when I left WGN.
I'm trying to figure out, and you do touch on it in the book, but what is it that first drew you to a career? I mean, you have more than 40 years in the business.
Right.
And as it shows in, as you read, as you should, people, in Murder in the News, this was not just a joyride for you. You take a really analytical and personal look at news, so you've thought about it a lot. What was it that first drew you into that business?
Well, it was really an accident. I was pre-med in college in the 60s, and I was a terrible student the first time around in college.
Afraid of blood, or what were you?
Well, no, I loved that, but I mean, it was I just wasn't a very good student. I was a late bloomer, and I was at Morehouse College in Atlanta, and there was which was an all-men's school, and there was Spelman College across the street, which was an all-women's school.
All women's.
And I spent a lot of time at Spelman, which
nothing
was
wrong with
women's
that.
School.
It shows that you were alive.
And, of course, my grades suffered. And my father used to tell me, boy, get your grades up.
What did your father do?
My father was a dentist. And my mother taught at Spelman. She was a college professor. And, of course, my grades didn't get up.
So they obviously had some certain high expectations for their son, Bob.
They did. I was the oldest of three boys. And my younger brothers, both twins, were 8 years younger than I, and they wanted me to set a good example for them.
Sure.
And, of course, as I said, I wasn't
you
serious.
Were chasing girls.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. And so because of that, my grades fell, and I couldn't get a deferment, so I was drafted into Vietnam.
Wow.
And as long as you kept your grades up, you could get a deferment still, and
sure,
stay out.
Sure.
But my grades suffered, and, of course, I was drafted. Well, then I signed up again. Since I was pre-med at the time, I signed up for an extra year to work in the operating room. And so I was trained as a surgical assistant.
Mm.
I was originally because of my background in biology, I was originally a combat medic. But then they sent me to Fort Sam Houston for training as an operating room specialist. So I was in a MASH unit. And then when I got out of the Army, I was more serious, went back to school.
How long did you serve in Vietnam?
I wasn't ever
you
in
never
Vietnam.
Never went to Vietnam.
I never was
gotcha.
In Vietnam.
Gotcha.
I was actually in Puerto Rico at an Army hospital that is right at El Morro, which is that that old base right there in Old San Juan. And but then when
were you dealing there with wounded soldiers who were coming back?
Oh, yeah, who were coming back. That'll I was on burial detail.
That'll certainly give you a new perspective on
life. Yeah, and then after my time there, I did go to a MASH unit at Fort Bragg.
Wow.
And we were on – that was during Tet.
Yeah.
So I was on my way to Vietnam in Tet, but I phased out, got an early out to go back to college. And so that that was why I did not spend time in Vietnam.
Well, but also talk about even though you weren't in country, as they say, what a life-altering experience to deal
was,
with these young people. They're your age. You're looking at yourself.
And I'm seeing them in the operating room.
Yeah.
And I'm working on them hours and hours and hours because they were coming back through the chain, not through the chain of command, but through the hospital system of the field hospitals and then back through Germany, back into the United States. And then finally, they would get more and more treatment, we would do sometimes follow-up treatments and that sort of thing. And but during the height of Tet, it was just we were just
bloodbath.
Overrun. Hospitals
bloodbath.
Were full.
Bloodbath.
It was just amazing.
That would give you a an interesting and forever alter your perspective on life.
It did.
Not?
It really
and especially
did.
On life and death, which is one of the subjects of your new book, Murder in the News: An Inside Look at How Television Covers Crime. We do, like television, have to break for commercials every once in a while, and we're going to do that right now for a couple minutes, and I'll be back with Bob Jordan to continue talking about the book. First, I'll tell you this week. Welcome back to After Hours. We continue on with Bob Jordan. He's just taken us through his life as a red-blooded man chasing after some girls at Spelman College in Atlanta, and then the horrors of working as a medical assistant, I guess, surgical assistant during the Vietnam War, dealing with the tragedies that were able to return. How do you go from there to becoming a venerable newsman? What got you into TV? You said it was almost by an accident.
Yes, it was. I was in Nashville, back at school, back in college, and because I was really good in the operating room, I had all of this background in biology and anatomy, and the surgeons really wanted me on their cases to scrub. And I was working at Meharry Medical School at night and going to Fisk University during the day. And I heard about a position opening up at a television station in Nashville. So I got my college roommate and to drive me out to the TV station. I went in and knocked on the door.
Wow.
Asked for the program director. They took me down the hall to his office. We sat and talked for a while. He said, come with me. Took me downstairs into the studio. This was the television station, Rick, that I used to look at when I was 8 years old with Med Dennis.
Yeah,
where
with the Indian head on the tube. Yeah,
and here I was sitting at the desk doing a test,
an audition,
screen test, an audition, And they ripped off some wire copy right off the wire machines and gave it to me. It had all these Vietnamese words and expressions, and I read terribly. And it was just awful. And it was one of those, don't call us, we'll call you.
Yeah, of course.
And but they did, called me back. And I guess they saw something that they thought might have some potential. And they hired me eventually as a booth announcer. During that time, television stations had live booth announcers who would read the tags to commercials.
Yeah.
Available at Walgreens, True Value Hardware Store. And then they would we would do station identifications live. You're listening to WSM Nashville.
You do that way. You still do that well. Yeah, you're in touch for that.
And so those were all live. WGN had them. Mary D. and Floyd Brown. And all of those people were booth announcers. That Jack Taylor was even a booth announcer at that time. And so, but of course, as technology improved, they went to live cassettes and did away with booth announcers.
Well, because it was cheaper, too. And
right.
As you and I both know, that's what big media companies are into.
The so that was how I started, and I stayed at the station for 3 years and worked with a really sharp AP Associated Press writer in WSM, which was a 50,000-watt radio station.
Oh, that's big.
And this guy was really sharp, and he would work with me on news writing and redline my copy and throw it back at me, and I'd rewrite it and give it to him, and he'd redline it and hand it back to
him. That's better than 4 years in any journalism school, I can tell
you.
And I
did that every day, and I got better and better.
Did you like it?
I do. I knew that this was something that I liked right away, and I felt right at home.
Yeah.
And so when I got the offer to come here to Chicago in 1973, I was pretty nervous about it.
I'll bet.
But a guy by the name of Chuck Harrison picked me up at the airport and drove me out to the station and said, you know, we have the number one radio station here with Wally Phillips, and there were two helicopters parked right there on the
helipad. I remember what those helicopters looked like. No one would get in one now, I'll tell you that.
Wow. Right. Yeah. And WGN, I walked down the hall, and there were typewriters going inside the newsroom, and every typewriter, every reporter had a cigarette burning next to it, and it was wonderful.
But it felt like your kind of place.
Yeah.
Wow. When did you start reporting? That must be when you started reporting.
That's exactly when I started
reporting. The other question I need to ask you, Bob, is there had to be very, very few African Americans in this business then.
Very few at all.
Yeah.
When I walked in the newsroom, there were no other black faces there.
I'll bet.
And no women at all.
Wow.
And, you know, it was stunning just to see. And so eventually Gloria Brown came over from the other side, and Richard Isaac was a cameraman. And stations began making a concerted effort at hiring minorities during this time.
Yeah.
And
well, because it reflected their viewership.
That's one
of the things in Murder in the News, that an inside look at how television covers crime, Bob Jordan's compelling and arresting new book, is that many people who work in newsrooms, and I'm talking about assignment editors, and I'm not generalizing, but I'm kind of generalizing, they don't know much about the cities they are covering, the cities they are sending reporters into, or the neighborhoods.
The assignment editors really do.
Okay.
They are, when you at the TV stations in Chicago, you have some wonderful assignment editors, and they actually are the hardest working people in the newsrooms.
Sure.
Because they are the ones who have to monitor all of the police radios, and fire, and the wire services, and the phone calls, and then dispatch the crews and the reporters, and all of that at the same time. And when they miss a story, then they're the ones. The news director walks out and says, "What in the world's going on? How did you miss that?"
Yeah,
you know, they rarely get attaboys.
Sure,
but they work hard. Good assignment editors know how to get crews around the city to good locations and what's doable, because that's another consideration. Is the story doable?
Right.
If it's not doable, then sometimes you won't send a crew there.
Don't you think, Bob, we're going to be all over the map. We'll get back to your career climb in this town. But much of coverage is dictated by what video you can get.
It's absolutely,
if not solely by what video.
Yes.
That's why we were just talking before the show about weather being an increasingly important, yet to my mind, incredibly superficial means of news. Let's start with the weather.
Right.
Let's start,
yes.
Okay, it's winter, it's cold here. I don't,
right.
But look, there's
Chicago,
someone slipping there. There is a tow truck. Much of coverage on local news especially is dictated by what video is available.
Yes, and in the case of why we are seeing so much emphasis on weather,
mm-hmm.
is because weather wars are going on now.
Yeah.
Every station is attempting to beat Tom Skilling,
yeah.
who in this town has had for years the reputation as being the top weather guy.
Well, but there's also something, there's some kind of magic in the way Skilling presents. If you were to, it's the same thing that I think about when you think of famous TV stars in this town, like Siskel and Ebert
right.
are about two of the most unlikely looking television stars
yes.
in history, as is Tom. As
yes.
great a guy as he is,
yes.
he doesn't scream George Clooney.
No.
You know, he doesn't.
But he's the nicest man in the world.
Oh, my God. That,
yeah.
There's no question about
yeah.
that. So they're all
and
trying.
And it comes across.
Oh,
and
see what, but that's the magic. That's there's
the
something.
Magic of television.
Yeah.
And many anchors today don't realize that viewers are able to pick up on nuances like
sure.
that, and they can tell a really nice guy from a guy who's not.
Well, I think there's ever been, and I know you know this, there have been consulting firms. If it was that easy to sit in a chair, it is not difficult to sit in a chair and read, you've done it, I've done
right.
it, to read a teleprompter.
Right.
There are many, many thousands, millions of more difficult things in the world. Anybody can be taught to do that.
Correct.
But to do it in a way that makes you Walter Cronkite or makes you a Ron Majors or makes you, the difference is one of the great mysteries,
right.
I think. It's like sort of what they say about actors, the magic through the footlights on stage. It's an amazing thing. So when you would, here's something too that Bob, I'm going to read some stuff from Bob's book because I love this book. You can look up a piece I did. Not long ago, on November 28th, it was kind of a Thanksgiving present. I was flabbergasted by the book and wrote about it for the paper. You can look that up, too. But here, Bob writes about recognizing news, and he says, many people have tried to define the term news. The answers are as varied as the people who are asked to give a definition. He has Leo Rostin, the famous political scientist, philosopher, and author, say, When a dog bites a man, that is not news. When a man bites a dog, that is news. That's famous. Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine, said, good news isn't news. Bad news is news. I will add, and love you to comment about it, because we both heard it a million times vis-a-vis the television news business. If it bleeds, it leads. I don't know who coined that. But that's a relatively pervasive philosophy in TV news, is it not?
Yes, it is. And more so now, more so today than in recent history.
Yeah.
And the pendulum swings back and forth in regards to that, Rick. As any observer can tell you, there are times, just as it, Happy News and Happy Talk came in and out
sure.
of vogue. And right now, there's been this change. And a lot has happened with regard to why we are seeing the news that we do.
Yeah.
Most of all is that these consultants have told news directors that you need to say breaking news in order to gather your audience.
Yeah.
And so most of the time you'll see breaking news, developing stories, and it may not be for something that's truly breaking. It could have happened earlier in the day.
Well, I mean, yeah, breaking news, it's cold.
Yes.
Crazy.
It's the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah.
And the public sees through that. And people have told me over and over again, why are we seeing that? And that's going to go away, too. It's just going to take a while for some news director to be the first to say, enough of this.
Yeah.
Let's break away from this emphasis on breaking news, news.
Well, I think they've always, television, because, in the early days, guys like you and I are watching test patterns, that I think the people who run television have got it in their heads that we're all a bunch of idiots out here. I really do believe that with due respect to the many smart people working in television, I think part of it is what you said, Bob, Bob Jordan, the consultants have been driving this thing, and as social media has gotten more pervasive, and cable television, we're talking in an era of before cable, when cable came, 24-hour news cycles, there was a real desperation in news shops around town with local news, because there's still a money-making operation, local news, but there's a desperation to. Bob Jordan and I are going to talk this whole hour about what we've been talking about. We'll get away from his career and get into the details. The fascinating story of at the beginning of the book, that Mel Reynolds story, is really something. It is really something. He'll be here for the whole hour. The book is Murder in the News, an inside look at how television covers crime, and it is an inside look from a man who has been on the front lines of that for more than four decades. You're listening to Small Bumps from a rare CD called Kurt Weill, From Berlin to Broadway. And I'm shortening those bumps because I have Bob Jordan in here for an hour, and we're talking about his book, Murder in the News, an inside look at how television covers crime. It begins with a telling anecdote. Would you tell that, please?
Sure. You know, the reason that I wanted to begin with that was because I still remember that this day. And it was something that doesn't happen very often, but it was in 1994, and I'd come into the office, and I was rushed right out the door and told, don't sit down, head out to Mel Reynolds' office. And when I got there, there were all of these reporters and camera crews and still guys and everyone standing around, radio and television. And we were all there to try and ambush Mel because he had been indicted on charges of having sex with an underage campaign worker.
Yep.
And this was a huge story. And we could all sense that this was going to, because there were network guys there as well. And we figured that everybody was trying to, you know, figure out how we could tell the story differently or whatever. And I felt this tap on the back while I was there. And this, I turned around, and there was this older black woman standing behind me smiling and said, "Hello, Mr. Jordan." And she said, "I'm so glad that you guys are here today covering the story about the shooting of those three boys." And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about." And she said, "The story that happened yesterday about those three boys who were shot." I said, "No, I don't know about it." She said, "Well, what are you here for?"
Yeah.
I said, "Well, we're here covering the indictment of Mel Reynolds." She said, she walked up closer and kind of began poking me in the chest with her finger, "Don't you think that the shooting of three of our boys is more important than Mel, quote, sleeping with that strumpet?" She said, "That's, what do you think?" And she just paused and said, "I'm ashamed of you." And all of my colleagues by that time had quieted and were watching this, and she turned and walked away.
Yeah.
And a producer walked over and said, "You know, she's right. We should be covering that. But hey, you know, that's just not the way it works in this business." And it wasn't. And I couldn't explain that to her, that I couldn't take myself off of a story and, you know, that I would call it in and hopefully get somebody else there. And I never forgot that.
Yeah, obviously. And, you tell it so powerfully. You also write in the book, and I'm quoting from Bob's remarkable book, Murder in the News, an inside look at how television covers crime. When you buy and read this book, you will look at television news in a different and, I think, healthier way. Bob writes this. In many major American cities, the public rarely gets a true picture of these neighborhoods where crime, unemployment, rival gang wars, other negative factors undermine the abilities of residents to live congenial lifestyles. And that they don't get a picture of these people who struggle by the hour just to survive and eke out an existence. Media outlets rarely spend the necessary amount of time in these sour, and I love this phrase because that's what it is, you call them these sorrowful neighborhoods, telling the gritty tales of survival that go on in millions of homes around the country. These stories are ignored and forgotten, and therein lies some kind of tragedy in the way the media operates. And I'm talking about newspapers, too.
Right. Well, I've been aware of that for so many years.
Yeah.
And it's not just racial. It's not sexist. It's not socioeconomic. It's kind of all of those. Yeah. And it's really based on what we call news. And when you talk to assignment editors and producers and folks at the city desk, they'll tell you that they have a tacit understanding of what is news and what isn't. But it's more to it than that. There are nuances. And one of the things that I point out in the book is we cover some stories and we don't cover others.
Sure.
And why is it that we don't? It could be as simple as a perception that we have about the importance of some people more so than the importance of others.
Yep.
And I use that as an example. If you had a black kid on the West Side who's a gang member and he's shot and killed, we may not cover him.
Right.
But if you take that same kid, put some school books under his arm and have him walking to school when he's shot and killed, we'd have helicopters in the sky.
I will also maintain, and you do address her in this book, that as tragic and sad as it was, the idea Pendleton is shooting,
mm-hmm.
it is possible had she not been at the White House,
right.
you know, weeks before,
exactly.
that certainly might not have gotten the kind of coverage it did.
And the fact that her mother and father were not going to let, because
yeah.
assignment editors and producers and other reporters kind of, we took for granted that she might be a gang member or something. And her parents said, no, she's a good girl. She's a smart girl. She was an honor student. And she even marched in the parade for the inauguration of President Obama.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, all of a sudden, gave her a special hook upon which we could hang the story.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, her death became so important that the governor attended her future. Michelle Obama flew into town, the mayor, all the civic leaders, and there was a complete turnaround in covering her story.
And very little change. That's one thing that we both know terribly well, that something will take over the news and, you know, be a story and the big story for a time, and then it vanishes because the cycle changes and there's a new celebrated death.
Well, the night that Hydea was shot and killed, there were two other people shot and killed in Chicago as well. And I found out who they were. And I spoke with the sister of one of the men who was killed. And she said she didn't feel bad about the fact that Hydea's family had gotten so much attention and they had that $40,000 reward.
Yeah.
But she also said that the people who killed her brother were still at large.
Mm.
And there wasn't as much pressure brought to bear by city officials and the public to solve that crime as it was Hydea's. And so she said because of that, the people who killed her brother were still at large.
Yeah. I once met, when I was doing for another station, a woman who had had three of her kids shot and killed on the streets of Chicago. And I could barely. She had three other kids, and she was worried they, too, were going to get it. When that decision is made very fast, I mean, obviously, if someone, obviously, the murder-suicide that just happened in Lake Forest, mm-hmm. Of all places, that probably hasn't had a murder in 20 years, good for them. We both know instinctively that's going to get a coverage
correct.
Kind of out of whack in a murder-suicide in Lawndale, for
right.
instance. Those decisions have to be made in that newsroom really fast,
don't they, Bob?
Yeah.
They are. And I set out a questionnaire.
Yes, which is a fascinating part of the book, too.
Yeah, to the assignment editors and producers in Chicago. And many of them responded angrily,
yeah.
saying, you know, how dare you ask us to answer these questions because we would cover them both.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a series of scenarios, and I'll give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
I said, let's take, for instance, there is a shooting on Michigan Avenue, and there is a shooting on King Drive. You have one reporter in the newsroom. Where are you going to send him?
Mm-hmm.
And right away, you know you're going to send that reporter to Michigan Avenue.
Of course.
And I wanted to know why. And so I built these scenarios, sometimes making them stronger with the area that I knew was would not get covered.
Oh, of course.
To see. And that elicited some really strong reaction from the assignment editors and producers, and I included that in the book.
And you sure did. I mean,
just I wanted to be transparent so that we could see what their thoughts were about how they would cover stories, whether it was a cell phone store on the west side and a
bagel store in Skokie.
Exactly. Yeah. Where are you going to send the crew?
See, I also think in doing that, and it would take another survey to ask them, but I think in doing that, you did a real service to them, too, because I think the newsroom, any newsroom, necessarily moves so fast that there's not a lot of time for reflection.
Right.
You are going to get chewed out if you don't cover the story that is covered with the breaking news cryon at Channel 7.
Right.
You know that, and so you are making these instinctive reactions, and to have to sit back and ask yourself why you made those, I think is healthy.
Right. But, you know, part of the competition among television stations is, as I point out in the book, really useless, because how many people do you know have three or four television stations, three or four television sets right next to each other, one watching a different newscast? And if you did, you would notice that many days the same stories are appearing in the same first segment. They're starting off the same second segment. And that same hierarchy, the way stories are stacked, takes place every day.
Yep.
And if you sit in a control room where there are television stations with all the other the competition on, it's interesting to watch how the producers all seem to know instinctively how to stack the shows so that they are all basically the same. Yeah,
because they're all especially the 10 o'clock news, 10 and 9 on certain stations. It's they are looking for and need. It's a visceral reaction they're looking for. If it bleeds, it leads. Or if it freezes, it leads too. 15 more minutes with Bob Jordan, and it's been. Read the book, Murder in the News, An Inside Look at How Television Covers Crime. It will allow you, it will be a favor to you. It will allow you to look at television news and perhaps even newspaper news, too, in a different and, I think, much healthier way, especially in a place like Chicago where the streets are continually bloody. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I have 10 more minutes with Bob Jordan, distinguished journalist, recently retired after more than four decades covering everything and anchoring also the news, as does his daughter Karen on weekends at Channel 7, as does his son-in-law, Christian Farr. What do you tell them, Mr. Jordan, about this crazy? I'm sure they were helpful with the book. They read the book. I know that. What did they say to you, those two, who are still in the business?
Right. Well, you know, believe it or not so much them, but my wife.
Yeah.
She was the only one in the family who was not in television, so we used to call her the civilian.
The smart one, yeah.
And so we would bounce thoughts off of her. And I have always, she was a librarian, and I've always never let any copy go out of my hands without running it by her. And she's always been very good at watching my copy. And when I talk with Karen and Christian, I remain hopeful about this industry. You know, even in the light of these charges of fake news and all of these things that we hear today, I know that no producer has ever told me how to write a story or anything like that. And I know that, there has been fake news. I mean, when you go to the checkout stand in the supermarket, boy locked
Elvis,
in closet eats own foot.
We've
always seen the globe and the world and all of those. They've always been around. And that hasn't changed. That's always been fake news. But we in television and in newspapers like the Tribune and the Sun-Times and the Washington Post and the New York Times, there's no fake news there.
Yeah, I know.
And
I know.
And what we have to do The responsibility now falls on us as journalists to make sure that we are more careful in how we document what we are saying and how we make sure that we don't blur the types of news reporting that I was looking at. Tom Rosensteel was talking about how journalists have to be more careful about when making sure that we allow our readers and our viewers to follow our train of transparency,
sure.
So that we document with footnotes if we can, and have to be more careful to document what we're doing.
What about the without, yes, it has a great deal to do with fake news, with the instantaneous news available on Twitter and Facebook and every other place. That has affected, I think, newsrooms of all sorts, radio, television, and thinking that you know, talking about breaking news, I mean, it was the way that stations used to say, we want to be the first to say that so-and-so won Iowa in the primary. That can be an insidious kind of influence, don't you think, that need to be first and fastest? And
oh, of course it can, and some stations have been burnt because of that.
Yep.
But
recently, yeah.
But you know what? It's specious to try and do that because viewers are only watching one television station at a time.
True.
They do not know if they're watching Channel 9, they don't know that Channel 7 was second to get the news about this, or that Channel 5 was first to get the news about that. They don't know. All they know is what they have seen on the station they're watching.
Yeah.
What they don't know is they don't know, and it's not important to them. So we, as insiders, are trying to get that attaboy from our producers and our news directors and our editors. So we are racing to try to get the story out there and be number one. And if you aren't careful, you can step on yourself by not making sure that your facts are correct and that they are accurate and that you are getting the information out as it should be and not having to come back and make corrections. But if you do, make those corrections as big as the mistake was that you made.
You make some other hopeful notions in here that a broader, more diverse staff will improve news content if once television, especially, and really true of newspapers, starts reflecting the communities that buy them, and that murder stories should be judged from ethical considerations. I could not agree with you more.
It makes us richer when when we have a more diverse reporting staff and editorial staff. It helps us. I can't tell you how many times I have wanted to, and I do. I'm quick to pick up the phone and call someone or check my information here or there. And if I know that in the newsroom we have people from this background and that background, then I can talk to them and get an idea. That helps me.
Oh, absolutely.
And that in turn helps my viewer, because if it helps me give them a better picture about the story I'm telling.
Now, you are busy promoting this wonderful book, Murder in the News, An Inside Look at How Television Covers Crime, that actually should be a textbook in journalism schools around the country, as well as just a marvelous reading experience that will change the way that you look at the way especially your local news here in Chicago is covered and covered in general. It will make you a smarter viewer, and there is nothing wrong with being a smarter viewer. You're busy
Chicago's
with that.
Chicago's a great news town.
Yeah, oh, it always has been.
Our public is lucky to have. We have some really fine journalists
here
in town.
I agree. You also are busy with your production company of some 10 years, the Video Family Biographies, which is videofamilybiographies.com, which make 90-minute long biographies of families and individuals. That's an interesting thing. Do you miss, busy as you are, Bob Jordan, do you miss the daily grind of that TV newsroom?
I do, to some degree, Rick, because when there's a big story that breaks out, you know, you want to be there. I can remember when I'd get an assignment and I'd jump in the car with a cameraman, we'd speed off, and, you know, we couldn't get there fast enough.
Yeah.
And that hasn't gone away. But, you know, I can watch it now. I always have been able to, as someone who's been in the field, to sit back and watch it and know how it was put together and
sure.
all of the elements that are involved and whether the story is coming together well or whether they're having problems. And so, and now with social media being, journalists are getting to the scene and they're having to take pictures and then get information to the station website and then tweet and do for Facebook. And so they have more responsibility.
Yeah.
And also, because of technology, they can. When I started, it was film.
Yeah,
and
right,
you had
right, right,
you couldn't
right,
get
right.
anything on the air for 2 hours. Well,
right.
of course, that changed over the years. Now you can pull up to the scene, and then you
and
jump
feed.
Out of the car, and the
Let's
producer is saying, "How soon can you go? How soon can you go?"
Yeah,
and a reporter needs to say, "Give me a minute.
Yep.
Give me a minute." They shouldn't be afraid to say, "I need a minute to go over here and talk to the police chief to get this information." Don't just stand there and start dancing around in front of the flashing blue lights and just
say
anything.
Well, the other thing that always has bugged me about some television, that I don't mind. If you're at the scene of an event, that's great. When it's like, hi, we're standing at the 4th District here, and, you know, 5 hours ago something happened here. That drives me nuts because it's a fake immediacy is what it is. Do you watch the local news every
day?
You still watch?
I still watch.
Is it like it's a habit?
Yes. I switch around, and I always have.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Karen's on, I'll watch her. And
of
then
course.
I'll catch Christian. And then, but I also watch different stations just to see a different perspective on a story. The reporters are younger. It doesn't necessarily mean they are as experienced. News, like anything else, you know, I often think if you have a surgeon getting ready to go in and perform open heart, do you want the guy right out of med school or do you want the old guy who's been around? And
I want the old guy. I want the old guy who might even be smoking and drinking while he's going to cut something out of me. Bob Jordan, it's a remark. You can be not my place to be proud of you, but you can be incredibly proud of this book. What's been the reception from
it's done well. Yeah.
What about from your colleagues and contemporaries?
Yes,
business?
I was so pleased. My news director, Jennifer Lyons, who is quoted in the book, said that she thoroughly enjoyed it a great deal. And you know, I'm not out to criticize.
No, and you don't.
I'm trying to give an inside look at
This is not a criticism. It's an observation.
We're looking behind the curtain.
I'm not arguing with anything in there, having covered TV and watching TV. You are. It's a look behind the curtain of how things are done, and that 10 o'clock news is there, and then it's gone. You got the weather, you got sports, and you got some news, and it's gone. And how you digest it, and how you think about it, you know, it always generally ends that 10 o'clock news with something very pleasant, because they know you're going
Skippy
to
the
bed.
Water skiing squirrel.
Yes, that's right. There's a water skiing squirrel. God, remember that would have been the first YouTube video in history. Bob Jordan, it's great to see you, and your heirs, Karen and her husband Christian Farr, are fighting the good fight, and this will help them do
well,
it.
Well, I hope so. Thank you, Rick.
You
this
had a great career,
and
this is a great book. I hope you write another one.
Thank you.
I really
Thank you so
do.
Much.
My pleasure.
There once was a girl.
Welcome back. Second hour of the first show of After Hours for the year 2018. God, I made it through another year. This is unbelievable. There were times when I was in my 30s, it was like a, you know, 1 to 5 that I wouldn't make it. It is my pleasure to have in here. There's a new show opening at one of my favorite theaters, the 16th Street Theater in Berwyn. Ann Filmer, who runs the theater, who founded the theater, who directs many of the shows, themes each show. And the theme for this season is heroes. And it begins with a show called Harburgate, Harburgate, which is kind of three plays in one. Is it not Christina McCloskey and Christian Isley? It's like Christian is not in the show, but he's a consultant to the show. He's going to be in a show later in the Heroes season. Mm-hmm. You were the assistant director. Are you sloughing off tonight? What are you doing here?
I was graciously substituted in as our fearless leader is at tech at this very moment.
And Christian, the show is a kind of, am I saying, it's kind of like a, it's not a trilogy, but it's a three-part show. Can you explain it if you could?
So it's of three separate sections.
Okay.
And so
are there three acts?
Three acts, as it were, okay. And they each have their own title. So
right.
We have...
Even I've got that in.
Yeah, you have the breakdown.
They're self-contained, but they also kind of interlock.
They're thematically. I mean, they all take place.
Well, they interlock in ways that are unforeseen, and you know.
You can't give away all the secrets.
Exactly. No, I don't want to do that at all. But they are all set in Iraq.
No, just the middle.
Just the middle section. So, essentially, it is based around these groups of people, these duos per act, that are unified by one singular incident that took place between Harborgate and Mosul on the convoy between. So as the play unfolds, or each play unfolds, as it were, you start to see how these separate lives all intertwine based on this one unifying moment and how they're all domino effect.
Oh, how big is the cast?
Six.
Six people, mm-hmm. Two in each of the segments.
Correct.
Now, you came on as a advisor because you auditioned for a play for this season, and you've been cast in a play for this season, correct?
Correct.
And I suppose when you were being cast, and they, before you, never having been an actor, they must go, okay, tell us a little about yourself. Is that what they do? Even the great Ann Filmer, she'll say, tell you a little bit about yourself. And you said, well, I've served in Iraq, and that being, how did they know you served in Iraq, thereby allowing you to become a sort of advisor for this show?
I think when I was auditioning, I read the plays because I actually get my hands on the script beforehand.
So. Were you auditioning for this specific show?
No, sir. No, but
you really don't have to call me, sir.
It was any one of them I would have been glad to do. So I was reading aside from Wolf Within the Block, which is the next show, but I meant to mention that I had read Harborgate. And I was an Iraq vet, and I did find that to be a very well-researched, truthful show. And I had seen some other Iraq-themed shows. And
that you didn't find well-researched.
No, yeah, and that was sort of painful.
The interesting thing is this is written by a playwright I don't know, a Kathleen
Cahill.
Cahill. What does she know about Iraq?
I think she just did a research. She spent a lot of time with mm-hmm. veterans in, what is it, Salt Lake?
Salt Lake City. She reached out through their VFA there, and she actually interviewed veterans
there. Is she here while you're doing the read-through and rehearsals? You open on Thursday. I mean, previews start Thursday.
Mm-hmm. So she will be back for previews, and she was with us for the first week of rehearsals, which was huge, having her in there for that first read-through and the script analysis and going through all the nitty-gritty of the text.
Well, I know that Wallace Shawn was not in for the...
No, he came in.
Did he really?
Well, not in the beginning.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
he came in to see it.
He was conferenced in, but he did come in to see it. But.
See, I've never written a play either, and I think
there was communications, though.
Really? That's great. What are they doing tonight? They're doing a run-through or a read-through?
They're in the midst of a run-through with all the technical elements.
Full dress or no?
Full dress right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they're not even listening to the show. Well, they'll listen
to
it later.
I hope not.
Yeah, they better not be. Now, what do you do as... I'm going to talk to you both about your careers and your lives. What exactly does... What are your duties as an assistant director?
Well, it definitely depends on whether it's per this show versus per any other show.
Well, I'm sure it's for a million different shows. I mean, there's
there's no set definition,
sure.
Which is great because each show has, you know, so many different needs that essentially you just need another set of eyes. And that's what Anne talks
to. And another set of ears, too,
ears and just brain space in terms of, you know, whether or not it's can you, you know, where was that prop coming from over there? Did you happen to have eyes on that corner of the stage for this piece of blocking notation? So one person can't keep track of everything that's happening at all moments. So just being able to have another voice in the room besides the stage manager, who is wonderful,
yeah,
is a huge asset.
How were you drawn to the 16th Street Theater for this? You've been in Chicago for 2 years, and
two years.
Will get back to your biographical details,
sure,
of your life.
Yeah.
But what drew you to 16th Street?
So I had heard about it just on the fringes of positive things. It was one of those theaters.
Yeah, when you're out drinking with other theater people.
Out drinking,
hearing about. That's what it's about.
Well, it was one of those things. It was one of those big theaters kind of on the edges of my periphery. You know, maybe one day thinking, you know, I'll get out there.
What, 16th Street was?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
You know, it's definitely, it's one of those, you know, once you get up a little bit more big leagues than how I was originally thinking.
And yeah.
And actually did this great thing, which happens so rarely, is that she posted, "I am looking for an assistant director," on League of Chicago Theaters.
Yeah,
on
yeah,
their
yeah,
jobs
sure,
listing,
their website, sure.
Which is such a beautiful, rare thing that happens, because being able to find opportunities to assist and direct is posted and to apply blind, you know, not to get the shoulder tap or the referral, is so rare. So when you see it, you pounce immediately.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I saw it, was so lucky that that's the day I checked. It had been posted that day, applied, and it was a quick turnaround. So
what was the turn? Did you have to sit with Anne and you must have been interviewed?
So we talked on the phone, and she was actually at a new play conference in Florida. So we talked on the phone while, you know, I was at my lunch break at work and during the day job. And then... Yeah, we had a great conversation, and she liked some of my background, and we talked a little bit about new script development, because something I worked on.
Part of it must be, and part of it must be aesthetic. That like what, and this is really simplistic, but it's like, what kind of plays do you like? Who's your favorite playwright? I mean, some of it must be like that. Yes,
I think it depends on your passions, because I like. It sounds so simplistic, but to say, I know, what kind of plays do you like? Good ones, tasteful ones. You know, it sounds so
well,
you know, harsh to say.
It's not so much simplistic as it is pure.
Yeah. And I mean, and of course, that just depends on, you know, is it a story that needs to be told now? Is it something that strikes you? You know, is it something that moves you? And in terms of, you know, are these artists that you want to work with? And I had only heard wonderful things. So, and also, I, you know, 16th Street has such a huge history of developing new work.
Oh, God.
And that's something that
basically.
I have worked on in the past as well. And so talking about that definitely got us in the same road of, I think that we have the kind of flexibility and the working with playwrights mindset that allowed us to
work
together.
This is going to be so much fun, you
yeah.
two nice young people. That's Christina McCloskey. And not talking too much yet is Christian Isley, but we will let him talk because he's from Evanston. We've got to take a little break.
The prince in orange and the prince in blue and the prince.
Now there's a great actor singing there. That's Danny Kaye singing. You guys probably know.
I know Danny Kaye.
Danny, he's a genius. I mean, really, really a genius. So you, Christian Isley, were brought in as a, I guess, as an unofficial or official.
Official, yeah.
Consultant. What is your, is that for this show?
Yeah.
Okay. What do? You say you read it, you liked it. It is Harborgate, a sort of play in three interrelated acts.
Mm-hmm.
Harborgate being the name of the American soldiers would call a military base on the Turkish-Iraqi border. To give it veracity, you said you read the play and you found it incredibly well researched. And so are you there to sort of tweak nuances and stuff?
Just the voices of the characters sounded authentic. Because like I said, only one section actually takes place in Iraq.
But these are all, sorry, again, you guys, are all six of the cast members, do they all play soldiers or veterans or people who have been in the war?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So she brought me in. She wasn't sure exactly at first how she wanted to use me and put me through drills and stuff like that. And I'm like, that's not going to work. That's not going to be safe.
Yeah, interesting.
but I could make myself available for questions. And the actors have been working very, very hard, and some, you know, they can call and just sometimes just to have questions about, you know, psychological insight.
Really interesting. Interesting.
And then there are specific things about how you hold a weapon, because none of them have, you know.
Right. No, and, exactly. Yeah, right, right, right. And but it's everything from the physicality of it to the psychology of it, then, yeah. Right?
This is however they want to use me. I'm not there to impose myself on them.
Yeah, right.
And so some have taken, reached out to me. And some, you know, I think felt comfortable just handling it on their own, and there's nothing really required of me anyway.
Yeah. It sounds like it's if not fun, at least this has got to be very interesting for you, yes?
Oh, I'm always need a place to go at night.
Okay. Okay.
I'm happy if any group of people is willing to have me.
You're willing to be there.
Let me talk a little bit. That's my social life.
And what's your background? You grew up in Evanston. You go to ETHS or?
No. Okay. I was institutionalized from my freshman year to my senior year. So I was at ETHS for about a year total.
Okay.
So that'll give you an indication of, again, the kind of deep well that I have to draw from.
And being institutionalized is a pretty deep well. I don't even know if you want to give some details or not.
Well, it was in the world-famous Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas.
Sure.
I was a very problematic, troubled kid from what most people say, the jump. I think expelled from kindergarten. I was really defiant. Oppositional defiant disorder is, I think, what they call it. And that inevitably led to me getting an institution.
And then you kind of, not to put too fine a point on it, you kind of came back to Chicago and kind of screwed around for a while before.
Well, no, I mean, I worked. I was a manager. I mean, they were not the greatest jobs in the world, but I was always conscientious. And I was
Did you have your eye on a career then or no?
No, I sort of floundered about.
Just a survival.
I did always have acting back there and wanting to do it, and yet I never pursued it.
Why do you think that was back there? What do you think spurred that? What do you think planned it?
I guess the easy answer is fear, you know, and it's which would seem ironic given all that I've been through.
Yeah.
But I think it was fear of following the dream, because if it ends up not working out, well, then you lose it. But if you don't pursue it, well, then it's always there to pursue.
But, you know, there's something about acting, and I've known, God, so many actors over the years, from, you know, Amy Morton, Billy Peterson, I mean, just millions of them. And for some, acting has become and was attractive because it was kind of a refuge from self, that you were, as an actor, playing somebody else for lengthy times. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
You think that was part of the appeal of it?
Well, I think initially it was films, and that was the escape. And then there was this thing called acting that I found out about. And you know, the reasons that it is and has remained attractive change, you know, as time goes on. Right now I'm in a space that, yes, it's an outlet. But I'm also fascinated more now by the craft, you know, not just imposing my own baggage onto a part, but, you know, learning how to. It's strange that it took all this kind of long and winding road.
Yeah, it's a winding road. How old are you now?
I'm 43.
Wow, you look young. You really.
I like
that's
hearing
good.
That.
That's what. Yeah, I'm not an agent, but I mean, that's what you like
no,
to
I,
hear.
No, I don't ever get tired of hearing that.
Now, let me talk to you about. The reason you've become a consultant for this show that opens Thursday in previews at the 16th Street Theater called Harborgate is because you enlisted and went to Iraq. Why did you do that?
Well, the answer, and I think when it comes up and people are probably tired of hearing it,
I'm not before, tired, right? Right. This would be the first.
Nobody joins the infantry at 30 because they made good decisions, right? So
yeah,
I was in my 20s. I was working. like I said, supporting myself with occasional horrifying flare-ups of violence things that it would do to get myself into trouble. And I left one job under extremely bad circumstances. You know, like I'm throwing chairs, I'm throwing fire extinguishers, I mean, I'm going and wondering if the cops are going to show up at my door once I get home. And they didn't call the cops on me, but I didn't end up working again for two years. And then, and I'm applying places, and I'm for the first time.
You must have been almost homeless, though.
I was, you know, and then I started drinking more. I always was a big drinker.
It's a bad spiral.
It was a death spiral. Yeah. And relationships ended, and suddenly I'm all alone.
That's hard to believe.
In an apartment, drunk. And it was.
Then I got to get out of here.
Well, I had been arrested three times in 1 month. They released me each time. There's no charges filed, thankfully. But after the third time, I was like, I need... So I went to the recruiter's office. And so I'm a kind of in a really bad shape, 29-year-old, I think it was at the time. And they were taking everybody because there was two wars going on. They're not going well.
Yeah.
Everybody had lost faith in him just about.
Well, they must have thought, they literally must have thought anybody walking in to
volunteer was nuts anyway. You'd be wearing an eye patch and have a peg leg. I mean, they would take anybody, And so I signed up, and I figure if I can get out of this, if I can survive this, and really, I was so desperate.
How did you deal? How did you with a temper? I'm not gonna.
Was a big concern that a lot of people had.
Psychoanalyze you? Yeah, I'm sure they did. But how did you fit into? You know, I don't care where you were working, what kind of job you had. This is the military. This is a structured environment.
No, that was a big concern. A lot of people had this. You don't respond to authority well, and you are going to put yourself.
You can't really be throwing fire.
You can't even talk back.
Yeah.
You can't even raise your hands. You keep your hands to yourself.
You can't be throwing chairs here.
It was a big question in a lot of people's minds, and I guess I was so down and out.
Did you have friends at this time? Did you have any friends? I mean, it sounds like you were...
In Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, when you were really down and out, that 3 years of no job.
I had one or two.
Yeah,
and they were not in positions to really be able to help me out, unfortunately. And I don't want to make it sound like I've got some aunts and I've got family that I'm sure would have taken me in, but that wouldn't have... That would have done nothing for my self-esteem.
So how long did you serve?
So 4 years.
Combat?
2 years in Iraq, in the Al Anbar province, which is the Sunni province.
Yeah.
So I was in Rupa and Cabeza.
You know, one of the other things, Christian Isley, is I would think to myself, and I don't want to belabor this, I want to talk about Harborgate and the future of our lives, but I would think to myself that even with the incredible structure of being in the armed service, that when you would get out, you'd lose it again, man. You know what I mean? It's like, hi, I'm back. What do I do now?
Yeah, no, I went right back to square one. I mean, I was, again, the story gets a little, I was married at the time. I was pretty well situated. My wife was very successful. I got married while I was in the military, in case you're wondering.
Yeah,
she came out of nowhere,
I'd go see this play. I'd go see the Christian Isley story. Yeah. That's what I'd go see.
People always say I should write one. So I had a home to come back to and a wife to come back to, and there was not that financial pressure.
Oh, so there was some stability then when you came back?
For about 3-4 months, and then she wanted me out and for her reasons. And so I went back to the North Side, and I ended up back on the North Side alone, drinking most of the time. But I had the GI Bill. I had the GI Bill, and I could use that.
You went first to Harold Washington, right?
First to Harold Washington. I ended up, I don't even know how I ended up in a play there because I was still drinking so much. But I made it through that play and somewhat intact. And I was like, you know, I'm never going to get another chance to do this again. And I walked over to Columbia, and I enrolled.
And the great thing about Christian in his short biography that I've read, he hasn't been in enough shows to have a lengthy biography yet, but he was sort of mentored by Sheldon Patinkin, who I've known since I was a child and was one of the great theater artists in the history of this town and also a great human being. So if you're a protege of his...
I wouldn't call myself a protege, but he helped. He's everybody's protege. That was what was amazing about him.
Yeah, no kidding.
He mentored anybody.
Call any of these guys. But I just think that's a good thing. We're going to talk more Christina McCloskey will now talk. I don't know if her background is as it's a fascinating, fascinating, chaotic, but maybe there's a play in that too. And Christy and I, they're both here, and we will talk more about Harborgate, 16th Street's opening play of their Heroes season. It opens Thursday, runs through February 17th at a beautiful space. I want to talk to you both about that space too, in Berwyn. It's 16th Street Theater, the number 168streettheater.org. Theater spelled the conventional way. We'll be back after the news. Okay, I have another half hour with Christina McCloskey, the assistant director, and Christian Isley, who I'm trying to convince to write a play of his life, but at the moment he is a military consultant and an actor who is going to be in the 16th Street Theater's next production titled The Wolf at the End of the Block, a play by one of Chicago's leading young playwrights, Ike Holter, who will become the Black David Mamet by the time he's finished. What's that play about?
That's a complex play. So it's probably easier to just talk about the themes that it touches upon.
Yeah, and Heroes.
And Heroes.
You're the star.
Heroes, and also
you have a starring role in this.
No, sir. No, it's a really very contained role, but it's a fascinating scene. It goes on for about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes or something.
Oh, nice. Ike's a good writer, man.
He's an excellent writer.
Yeah, he really
and,
is.
And I saw it when they had done it over at the Teatro Vista just a year earlier. I had auditioned for it over there as well. And
well, come back before
I was great to get another crack at it.
Come back before that opens, and we'll do a whole show about that.
Yeah.
Now I want to talk to you too. You are both relatively new, Christina. You're relatively new to Chicago. You've been here about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you come from?
So I came from Virginia. And that's where I went to school, and that's where I finished up high school, went to college.
And studying theater arts or
drama, okay. Good old general drama degree.
And where'd you do your time?
Yeah.
Where'd
you throw your fire extinguisher?
Where'd I dump my money? University of Virginia.
Okay, so you're in Virginia. Virginia, you look north, and up there is New York. And you look west, and over here is Chicago. And why did you choose to come here?
I know, and that was a big question. It's a lot of them. There's a huge network of UVA, especially the drama grads who are up in New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just not a New York girl, and I have plenty of friends who very much are. And I have to say, you know, that standard, you know, I love to visit, but I just, there's something about, I feel like one of my friends told me, who had lived in both places. He was an actor. He lived in L.A. He lived in Chicago. He lived in New York.
Yeah.
And he said that in Chicago, your roommate, who is also an actor, of course, will tell you, you know, I saw a great posting for you and you should go out for it. Like Christian was telling me in the lobby, like he's done that before.
Yeah.
And then he'll grab a beer with you after.
Sure.
And in New York, with your roommate and your other three roommates who are all also actors.
Right.
You sneak out when you go to audition.
Yeah, of course.
You don't want them to know.
Well, this has always been traditional, and I'm sure you're getting the sense of it now.
The competition.
A really nurturing town.
Exactly.
I mean, Chicago is, and it's almost become a cliche, but I mean, it is so nurturing for theater artists here that they really will give a helping hand up. I mean, it's true of every company that I know in this town. You found that to be true.
Absolutely. And that's what I was thinking of in terms of the type of environment that I was getting the vibes from in terms of New York was so competitive and cutthroat.
Yeah.
And I had people who I lived in Chicago for years, were at grad school, who would just sit and talk at me for 40 minutes about how wonderful and supportive this town was.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be in a place where it was a community where there were collaborators and people were not possessive or holding their secret actors or plays together, but sharing.
There is not here. I mean, Chicago has produced a number of major theater stars, but there doesn't seem to me, and I've been covering this scene for, God, 40-some years now, where there is that intense drive to... The definition of success here is not necessarily stardom.
Mm-mm.
The definition of success here is doing good work. Do you both agree? Is that a sense? Am I wrong, or is that still true?
No, I think it's. I think
is that
most,
how you
most,
feel?
Most of the actors that I come across, they know what it's about. I don't think anybody's unambitious.
No. But that can't be the goal. To you know, be in the theater.
If the goal is stardom, then you're gonna quit after 2 years because you're not gonna be a star.
Exactly.
You got a better chance of getting hit by lightning.
Yeah.
You know. But what there is a real community. I don't love everybody in the community.
Well, of course
but,
not.
But it's sort of it's analogous to the, yeah. to the army, right?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I don't want to hit that too hard, but it is a brotherhood. You're thrown in with a group of people. You have a common goal when you're doing a play.
Yep.
And you don't know necessarily about each other's backgrounds. You can be from different walks of life. And you might not necessarily, I mean, I don't know, I've worked with some people that, you know, I wasn't completely fond of, but you see them 6 months later, you give them a big hug.
Yeah, look because what you've been through this thing.
You were through
thing.
It with me.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's a good attitude. Okay, you two, you obviously have just seen very recently the 16th Street Theater for the first time, the physical space of it. You have seen other theaters in Chicago. You, Christian, have worked at the Red Orchid, which is arguably the most intimate theater in the history of theater in this city. The 16th Street, it looks comparatively like Soldier Field. What do you think? How did you find it? What did you think of it? I'm really interested. Like your visceral first response to walking in, great lobby, nice book, I don't know, and Filmer, the great Ann Filmer, has decorated the lobby for this specific show. And then you walk in the theater, and what do you think?
I was really excited. I like small spaces. Most of the shows that I've done have been in relatively small spaces.
Yeah, I like that too.
And I don't know what I would... I don't know if I could perform it. You know, I've gotten very used to that. It seems to suit me, and I'm very comfortable with it. So I would be intimidated, and I don't like being... I don't like the audience far away. I don't want to. I like it when they're
well because it can't get much closer than in Red Orchid.
And the steep space is really great, and they really utilize that space very well. Artistic Home's got a great small space. There's a lot of great. That's where I want to work right now. Is the best storefronts in Chicago, and Chicago's got a lot of them.
Christina, what did you think? What was your first impression?
The first thing I did
you went
was...
there and you went there probably and interviewed with Ann face to face, or did
so
she
I did
hire
a
you
phone the... call.
Yeah.
Phone call with her.
You told us that, yeah.
So, yeah, totally blind, walked in and, you know, didn't even, you know, had to do the whole figuring out, how do I get out to Berwyn?
Yeah, right.
Which, sure. You know, on the phone call, the first 10 minutes, Anne going, are you sure you know where it is? You know, just, are you sure you know what you're in for? And I'm like, yeah, I'm on it. Let's do this. And firstly, you know, from a very technical, like, theater perspective, I freaked out because the set was built. Day one, we walk in. The outline of the set is on the stage because they're not renting out that space.
Yeah, right.
Which is, from someone working from a lot of like smaller storefronts, that's insane. Like to actually be like, oh, here's your set that you get to rehearse on right now versus, you know, here's a classroom, here's a library room, here's this other space we rented. This is your home.
Right.
You get to be in it the whole time.
Yeah.
So
that's really something. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Have you two seen shows and visited places like Steppenwolf and the Goodman? Have you seen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been in the big ones.
Oh, yeah. No, I was. Those were the theaters that I was familiar with before I started acting.
Yeah, sure.
You Goodman, and because I'm Chicagoan originally. Once I graduated, though, I was like, well, I don't know anything about the theater culture in this town.
Yeah.
I started just going to see shows and once a week, twice a week. And I mean, last year I just fell short of my goal to see 100 shows. I saw 99 shows last year.
Wow. Wow.
And,
well, that'll keep you out of bars too.
Just, yeah,
nothing wrong
bars,
with that.
Yeah,
it'll keep you out of bars.
We gotta
take a little break. I'm having so much fun with these two. Christina McCloskey is the assistant director And Christian Isley is the military consultant and an actor who will be in the next show at the 16th Street Theater. But they both are involved in the show that opens Thursday and runs through February 17th. It is called Harbor Gate, H-A-R-B-U-R Gate. The 16th Street Theater is in lovely Berwyn. A lot of nice restaurants over on Roosevelt Road. Make a night of it. It's a great space. Ann Filmer is directing, and it's 16thstreettheater.org for tickets. We'll talk more about that show. It's sort of a three-part themed, I don't know. You guys, you're the theater artists. What do I know? You're going to describe it right after this little break. We'll be right back.
There once was a girl named Jenny.
Oh, this is such a good song, but I can't play the whole thing because I'd rather talk to Christina McCloskey and Christian Isley, both of whom are involved in Harbor Gate, the new show of the new season at the 16th Street Theater. The great Ann Filmer, who is out there now in a dress rehearsal for the show. It opens Thursday and runs through February 17th. It is three parts. One is sort of two Army medics about to receive Purple Hearts. Is that one of the things? And you receive a Purple Heart, of course, for being wounded in battle.
Wounded in combat, yeah.
There's another one about two Marines engaging in a battle of the sexes while on a truck convoy on the way to Mosul. And then there's another one, a veteran suffering from PTSD, finding comfort when she meets a blind painter in the park. Those sound really provocative and interesting, all of them.
And they are.
Yeah. And it almost reads more as, I don't, acts feel so separated. They're almost more, they're chapters of the same book.
Yeah.
But they stream together so well because it is, it's all, it's so many different stories, but it's also part of the same world, the same place.
Let me ask you, Christina, yeah. Do you find, you know, Anne always has the umbrellas for seasons. Is there a hero in each one of these parts, or is it a kind of bigger, kind of more mysterious kind of definition of hero?
It's such a loaded, I mean, that's the thing is, what is your definition?
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
I think it's figuring out, for me, the biggest part of the show is people figuring out how to live in the best way based on the situation that they're in. So whether or not, you know, you would define someone who is doing the best that they can or moving forward or looking back and then being accepting pain and moving forward, a hero. And, you know, yes, yeah. I think so.
This show must be particularly provocative for you, Christian, yeah?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, but I
has
think
it made you think about your own experiences over there differently?
Those
or
are never far from my mind. Yeah,
yeah. I bet.
But I think it's honest in, you know, what I always said about the guys I was in. My situation was maybe extreme when I joined, but it wasn't all that different for most of the guys that I was in with. You know, if you're in infantry, if you're in 11 Bravo, you're a bullet stopper, you know, and you're not there because, I mean, they're there for, it's a job. Maybe you're you know, 18 and you've already got two kids and the chicken plant closed, or you're trying to get away from gang life, or a lot of people use basic training as rehab. You know, not a lot of people who have better avenues, who have scholarships or something, are enlisting. So we're not necessarily the best and the brightest. You know, we're there for our own troubled reasons. Yeah. And so we kind of walk in with our own problems, and we do. I'm very proud of the service that we did. But then when you leave, you know, it doesn't necessarily prepare you
for anything.
It's blowing stuff up.
But you in reading this, you feel that Kathleen Cahill, the playwright, has captured it accurately. We were talking early on about it's both a physical, you're saying, physical advisor and also a psychological advisor too.
Just trying to make sense of the whole experience.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, you're very proud. On one hand, you're very questioning. On one hand, there's horrible stuff, but it's also sort of exciting. I mean, and because this play focuses on women.
Yeah, exactly.
Mostly,
no kidding.
Yeah.
There can be a sort of a double. It can be that much more difficult.
This question of identity, too, of that, you know, how you are part of a team, you're part of a brotherhood, but it is most of the time deemed that way. It's a brotherhood.
When you first read the show, and I know that there often a play can have this incredible transformation from page to stage. It's a remarkable, it's like watching a flower bloom from nothing, even as good as it could be on the page. What was it like for you? I mean, I don't know if you'd studied the Vietnam War or knew many veterans. Much of it must have come as a revelation for you, yeah?
I'm a Navy brat. So,
are you?
So, yeah, my dad was in the Navy for 35 years.
And you moved all around the country?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
All around the world, yeah. So
you are familiar with...
Well, that's the thing is I have a secondhand experience, but I also understand a certain, you know, a little bit about more of like the community that forms. I mean, especially there was a point in time that we were stationed in Italy in a tiny fishing village. And it was a situation of every single person that worked on the ship there. That was your community. That was your family. That was your home.
Sure.
Because you were isolated there together.
Yeah.
So again, you know, in terms of even that little perspective that I had from being a kid translated to, you know, a war zone.
Yeah.
You're isolated, you are there. That's who you're, those are the people who have your back. Those are the people that are your even remind you of America, of home, or wherever you come from.
I think it's fascinating that Anne is you guys don't know her as well as I do, but Anne is a very smart person. I think it's terrific that she got the two of you involved. You may have many, many other skills as an assistant director, but that level of understanding, I think, is an important thing here. And I think it's also important to bring you on. I don't care if you're cast in the next show or not. I like the title, The Wolf at the End of the Block. But to bring you on, just to bring a sort of increased or heightened veracity to everything. You know what I mean?
And honestly, even just the... Christian shared some videos of just the, you know, recreational time that you guys had.
Huh.
That was some of the most valuable. Like, researchers was just like seeing people... Seeing, like, what, comrades, friends who were just living, like, the day-to-day, like, in the movies and everything, what you're seeing, like, the heightened, utmost, you know, situation. But something that I love about the second chapter of the show is seeing, or even actually all chapters, is seeing, like, this is what people go through in their day-to-day life, both after and during their service. And sometimes that includes extraordinary, you know, situations, which of course unfold because this is a show.
Yeah.
So that you need those moments to happen, those magical moments. But a lot of it is just like what happens after, or what happens just on a car ride.
Yeah, well, no, it's not all Black Hawk Down, you know.
And right.
Stuff
yeah,
like happens, and you realize we still got two more years here.
Yeah. Well, you two are delightful. You are, to my mind, the future of Chicago theater here. I mean, you guys are smart.
I'm blushing.
Huh?
I'm blushing.
Well, you should be blushing, but it happens. I don't know if Sheldon Bettingen blushed. I'm not sure he was even on the radio just 60 years ago, whenever that would have been. But I, as a long-time lover of Chicago theater, just meeting the two of you lets me know it's in good hands.
Well,
good, interesting hands, too. You know, and then when you guys start making movies together, and you'd be on the Golden Globes one night 4 years from now. And
There you go.
And Filmer has an incredible, incredible eye for talent. And you guys, you like working with Ann. You don't have to say.
Oh, yeah. And the cast, too, I want to mention.
Yeah.
They are. She's assembled a great, great cast. And
Yeah, they're everyone. Like, seeing it all come together today.
Yeah.
Even when, you know, and I, of course, you know, I had to leave when they were about to, like,
yes,
start.
Yes, I'm sure. Like, yes, I have to be on the radio.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I have to go. I have to go. Spread the news. But like,
when's the formal opening? I know it starts previews on
the 11th.
Thursday.
Yes.
The press opening's a
18th.
Week from then, the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
You guys will be in the audience, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Every night.
If I can get a ticket. If I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they added 2 new rows of seats.
What?
There. Mm-hmm.
They've ruined the 16th Street Theater.
No,
that's unbelievable.
No.
I'm joking.
Even more intimate.
Yes, even more intimate. They're just aspiring to
closer.
Be the Red Orchid Theater, yeah. The most intimate theater in the on the globe. It is a real, real pleasure to meet you two, Christina McCloskey and Christian Isley. The show is Harborgate. It's the 16th Street Theater's first play of the new Heroes season. Each season is themed by Ann Filmer. It opens Thursday. In Berwyn, just go to 16th Street Theater. That's a 16th Street Theater, ER.org for tickets. And find these two characters in the audience and say hello. Thank you both. And
thank you.
Continued success. You got to keep coming on to tell me what you guys are up
to.
Well,
I'll come back every week. If you
I'll come
me.
Back for Wolf at the End of the Block.
Yeah, no, your next year. Yeah. The Wolf at the End of the Block. We'll have Icon and you come in. You're gonna do, what are you going to do for that show?
Are you Can I be the assistant director for that too?
Wouldn't that be great? If
oh,
that's
no,
how
it's
we
Lillian
do?
Brown's directing
okay.
that one. So.
Well, you'll both be back on the show because I think the future of Chicago theater is in good hands with the two of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Lise Graham, thanks for producing. Aubrey Mumpower, you haven't lost a step in the 2 weeks we've been gone.